From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
This week on the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Each year, the governor and the legislature set forth the upcoming year's priorities through the state budget. In the recent past, the discussion was what to cut to fill a $20 billion deficit. The infusion of new revenue from the passage of Prop 32 years ago, coupled with an improving economy, has changed the debate. From a discussion of what programs to cut to fill a gaping deficit, to whether a growing surplus should be used to restore those cuts or retire the state's long-term debts. What does the state's near and long-term revenue picture look like? We'll ask. Mac Taylor, leader of the state's nonpartisan legislative analyst office. H.D. Palmer, with the state's Department of Finance and the governor's chief spokesperson on the state budget. And John Myers, KQED's senior editor on politics and government. We'll also hear from Paul Hurley, former editorial page editor of the Visalia Times Delta, and California State University Fresno political science professor Jeff Cummins. California's 2014 budget season, joyfully normal?
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from Paramount Agricultural Companies, growing healthy food for you and your family.
From the California Channel at the state capitol, Valley PBS and the Maddie Institute, it's the Maddie Report with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Our guest is Mac Taylor, California's legislative analyst and the state's leading authority on the state budget. We're delighted to have him back on the Maddie Report.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Well, the economy seems to be picking up. What does the state's revenue picture look like?
The state's revenue picture looks very good. We're forecasting increase in general fund revenue, the state's major operating account, of over $7 billion from this current fiscal year to the one that will be starting on July 1. So that's good growth, especially after what we've been through over the last six years.
It wasn't that long ago we were talking about $20 billion deficit, so it's quite the change.
Exactly.
You know, I don't think people understand that not all taxes are the same. Could you explain very briefly the difference between sales tax, corporate tax, income tax, capital gains tax? They don't all come in at the same level. In fact, some go up, some go down.
Yeah. I mean, right now, about two-thirds of our general fund revenue comes from the personal income tax. So it's far and away the most important and the one we probably spend the most time on. We get about 20% from the sales tax and about 10% from the corporate tax. They all behave differently. The personal income tax has been doing very well, primarily driven by the financial markets that are all-time highs. The sales tax, although it's growing year over year, has actually come down. We've come down a little bit in our estimates of that growth. And the same with the corporate tax. They're a little...
Why do they come down when capital gains is going up?
Well, on the sales tax, for example, a very important indicator of how it's doing is what's happening in the construction markets. Uh-huh. And even though housing prices are high, construction hasn't been at the level that we had predicted even last year. So when you don't build houses, you don't buy a lot of goods, you don't buy a lot of appliances to fill them up.
Refrigerators and everything
exactly.
else.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, a major point in this year's budget negotiations was a difference of opinion on revenue estimates between your office and the governor's office. Your revenue projections were $2.5 billion higher than the governor's. Why?
Well, we would like to say that the governor's was 2.5 billion lower than our numbers. Look, on a $107 billion budget, that difference actually isn't all that much. We give an estimate, but there's lots of variability around that. But basically, even though that the administration and my office had a very similar economic forecast, including where the financial markets would be, they just had less money than we did. We had a lot more capital gains income because of how well the financial markets are doing. And this was the same situation we had last year. Mm-hmm. And it turns out we were right last year. Doesn't guarantee we'll be right this year. But we just think there's probably more upside than what the administration's numbers show.
You might have reminded the governor that you were correct last year, maybe. No, I told you so. You know, you were mentioning capital gains, and it seems like California is heavily reliant on capital gains. And of course, that's tied to stock prices. They spike, they go up, they go down.
And housing markets.
But right now, we seem to be, the stock market's been doing incredibly well. Are we in a bubble?
Well, we're no financial experts. We can't call when the market's going to turn. If we could do that, I wouldn't be sitting here. I'd be on my own private island somewhere. But I think what we do, Mark, is we do look at certain metrics, price-earnings ratios. Is the market way out of kilter? And when we look at those things, the answer is, well, no, not really. There may be a little more concern now than, say, a year ago. And we keep an eye on that. There's certainly greater probability that you could have a correction or a downturn. I'm not sure we'd think we're in a bubble, though, right now.
So high, but not bubble
high. Not dangerously high as far as we can tell.
Okay. You know, the other issue is this wild variability in revenues that come into the state. So there's been a lot of discussion about a rainy day fund. What are your thoughts about a rainy day fund?
Well, we do have a very volatile revenue structure, especially, as I said, we have two-thirds of our money comes from the personal income tax, and about a tenth of all of our money comes from capital gains in a good year. So that's quite a bit, and it's the single most volatile source. It goes up and down with the financial markets.
So one IPO for a company could completely change the state budget.
Especially if it's a California company.
Right.
So we do have a very volatile structure, and you can do two things to address that volatility. You can either change your revenue structure, not to be so dependent on capital gains. Yeah. We haven't taken that path. If you don't do that, you really need to have a strong rainy day fund. And what that does is, during good times, it helps you have the discipline to take money off the table, not spend it. And then when things turn south on you, you have a pot of money to help cushion the effects of that downturn.
I just was wondering, you mentioned that there are different revenue streams that are more stable as opposed to, say, capital gains or personal income tax. What would they be?
Sales tax is fairly stable. The property tax, even though it's not directly a state source of revenue, is an important one in California government, is a more stable source, especially because of Proposition 13 that was passed back in 1978. But in addition to capital gains, corporate income is very volatile. There are other components of personal income that are very volatile, proprietor's income and stock options and things like that. So it's not just a capital gains issue.
You know, I want to also ask you before we leave the segment about the governor's decision. He convinced the legislature to spend $250 million out of the cap and trade money for high-speed rail, and also talking about a continual appropriation of that money. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the governor wanted a third of all future cap and gain revenues, and the legislature and the governor decided on a 25%. That will generate a stream of money over time. I think the real question is that going to be enough to kind of fill in the gaps of our financing scheme for the high-speed rail system, which is supposed to cost like $68 billion. So I'm not sure it still gets us there, but it certainly helps in the financing.
Moves the train down the tracks,
I guess. Little bit.
Okay. We're talking with the state's legislative analyst, Mac Taylor. Despite the overall good economic news, California is still facing a wall of debt, according to Governor Brown. So I want to turn our attention to some of these long-term liabilities. First, you know, the public hears a lot of numbers bandied about, but what is the actual total cost of California's long-term unfunded liabilities, and is any of it being addressed?
Well, we recently put out a report where we estimated that these liabilities were about $340 billion. So that's about three times our annual state budget, or it's roughly 15% of the total output of the state in any given year. So it's a big dollar amount.
I think I read in your report it's also $8,500 per Californian.
Each Californian, imagine if you owed that debt to someone.
That'll get people's attention,
That's
sure.
A little bit easier to relate to, isn't it?
Right.
As far as what's being addressed, we do have mechanisms in place to pay off a lot of that. For example, included in the total is the infrastructure debt, bonds that we sell. But we have in the budget dollars to pay those off. So we are addressing that. And what we did is sort of break down that 340 and say we're addressing about 140 billion of it. 200 billion we don't yet have a plan for.
So 200 billion as a whole. And one of the places you were just specifically looking at was CalSTRS, the teachers' pension fund. And you say that's a top priority. Why is it a top priority? How large is the liability, and how fast is it growing?
It's the top priority because it's the largest single liability, really. It's almost $75 billion. Mm-hmm. And it grows. Every year that you don't address it, it grows by another $150 million.
Yeah, one thing that was interesting, the return last year for the fund was 12%, yet they still fell behind.
Right. Well, when you have the stock market does well, obviously you have some good years, but that has to offset a lot of bad years. And they also smooth out their gains, so you don't realize all that 12% in any one year.
So it's pretty large. It's growing at a fairly fast rate. You've also talked about, you know, CalSTRS not setting their own employer contribution rates. You kind of suggest that should happen. The legislature shouldn't be the one setting the rates. The board should, or CalSTRS should. Why?
Well, you want to have a mechanism that adjusts for changes in either your earnings for the plan or changes in mortality or when people are living, dying, retiring. And the legislature and the governor, to their credit, included in this recent budget plan, have adopted a proposal to address this $75 billion liability by having the state, teachers, and school districts pay more over the next 30 years to retire that debt. And it was a really important achievement.
But it would be a good idea, though, if we did. You still think it's a good idea if we moved it away from the legislature and to CalSTRS?
Well, it's more or less having the ability to adjust rates so that if that $75 billion, we were wrong on the estimate, it was actually $81 billion, or it's less, it's $65 billion, because we have higher than average returns over the next few years. You want to have the ability to make sure you're still paying off that debt over 30 years.
And that's not unique. CalPERS, the other pension system,
already has that.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So let's talk about the other big issue you mentioned in your report, and that is retiree health care for state employees. You say that is also a key priority. How big is that problem, and what should we do to fix it?
Well, that's over $60 billion. These are state employees who have earned benefits after they retire to pay for health care. And we don't pay for it as they earn those benefits, that is, during their life. We have a pay-as-you-go system that when they retire, incur health care costs, we pay for it then. And what we've done, in effect, is shifted the cost to future generations. And we think we need to do exactly the same thing. We need to start paying for them as they accrue. And we have to address this very large unfunded liability in the same way that the state just recently did for CalSTRS.
It's always difficult to do math on the fly here, but my math is then that these two liabilities, retiree health and CalSTRS, represent about 67% of the long-term unfunded liabilities.
The ones we weren't addressing. Exactly. So those are the two biggest pieces by far.
That's pretty considerable. You also mentioned, I think you mentioned something about if you started dealing with this problem, it's going to cost a lot less as opposed to putting it off. Can you give me a dollar figure on that?
Well, that's a little hard to do, but basically the principle is when you put money aside now, it earns money, and then the power of compounding.
Right.
So that the earnings are on those investments pay a large part of the ultimate benefits, and so you have to pay a lot less later on.
Have money work for you.
Exactly.
Also, just to let people understand the significance of this problem, the state is going to be doing a pay-as-you-go system on retiree health, and they've only set aside 0.1% of the 65.
Basically nothing.
Yeah, that's the point. So quite a bit of liability there. Well, so what's the choice for Californians? What will they lose if they begin to start funding these programs and taking care of these long-term liabilities? And what will they lose if they don't?
Well, what we lose now, if you think about us being the current generation that would have to pay for them, is we get to spend less on other things that we might like. More schools, universities, parks programs, or whatever, because in effect, we're paying for the past sins of others that didn't pay for it. But obviously, the benefits of us doing that is our kids and our grandkids do not have to bear those burdens. They'll have their tax dollars that they can spend on current services. So this is really just like Social Security and Medicare, the discussion at the federal level, it's which generation is going to pay for it. And we need to stop shifting it to future generations.
I think the key is delayed gratification.
That's it.
Well, I want to thank Mac Taylor, California's legislative analyst. Like every governor, Governor Brown has his priorities, and like others, he defines them by his spending proposals. So what exactly are they? We're fortunate to have a key spokesperson for the Brown administration with us today, H.D. Palmer, the Deputy Director of External Affairs at the California Department of Finance. Welcome back to the Manny Report.
Glad to be back.
So what are the governor's key priorities as set forth in this year's budget?
Well, the budget that the legislature passed in mid-June really reflects the priorities and the architecture, if you will, of what the governor proposed not only in his January budget, but in his revised budget in May. It continues to pay down debt. We're paying down about $10 billion of the so-called wall of debt in this budget, and if revenues come in above forecast, we'll pay down an additional $1.8 billion on top of that. We save for a rainy day. We make the first deposit into the state's existing rainy day fund of $1.6 billion for the first time since 2007. We significantly increase investment for education, $10 billion more this year for K-12 schools and community colleges, and a 5% increase for both UC and CSU, with tuition and fees being held flat for the second year in a row.
I think a lot of parents will notice that.
Students and parents,
that's
indeed.
Right.
And we make the first step to begin to shore up the state's teachers' retirement system. If left unchecked, that system is scheduled to be dry or unfunded in 30 years. That's not only a threat to teachers' retirement, it's a threat to the overall state's fiscal situation. So we've put into place a plan to be able to pay down the obligations and get that fund back in shape over a 30-year time frame.
You've also done a few things with pre-K. You didn't do universal pre-K, but you've added another 11,500 children to pre-K.
We did. It's a different proposal than what was proposed by Senator Steinberg, the former pro tem. But it's a proposal that we believe is doable and workable within the state's fiscal framework.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about this rainy day fund. Sure. There was a negotiation between the governor and the legislature about a rainy day fund that they're going to put on the November ballot, a change in it. So why the proposal? Why does the governor think that the current rainy day fund should be changed? And what exactly are those changes?
Well, a couple of reasons. First of all, the first rainy day fund, the one that's on the books right now, was passed in 2004. The problems are with that are a few. One, there has been no deposit into that fund since 2007. It can be suspended each and every year. There are no limits in terms of what can be withdrawn, and you have to make a deposit in good years and bad. So the legislature changed that and put ACA 4 on the ballot back in 2010. It's an improvement over Prop 58, but it has faults, too. It does not provide a viable means for the state to pay down its obligations. And it also doesn't deal with the issue of protecting education funding, which really took a big hit in the Great Recession. So the governor wanted to strengthen the rainy day fund, and he put forward a proposal which the legislature adopted on a bipartisan basis that will now go on the November ballot. And it changes the existing fund and the proposed fund in a couple of ways. It requires every year 1.5% of revenues to be deposited into the rainy day fund, as well as any capital gains revenue that exceeds 8% of the overall revenue in the state.
So if you get a spike, that money is going to go into the rainy day
fund. Right. And the spikes and drops in capital gains revenue, which is the most volatile revenue source we have, are the reason we've had boom and bust cycles in the budget over the last several decades.
So you're sure this is going to smooth things out?
Exactly. It requires for the next 15 years that half of that money goes to paying down debts, and it also provides that half of it goes into the rainy day fund. So we deal with the issue of paying down debt. It increases the size of the reserve from 5% to 10%. It limits the amount that can be withdrawn in any year to half of the fund so you don't drain it in 1 year in the recession. And it also provides a Proposition 98 reserve so that you've got a reserve within this rainy day fund that's designed to smooth out school funding if and when revenues decline.
A reserve within a reserve.
Exactly.
Well, let me ask you about that. You know, some have complained about a proposal that's in this rainy day fund that says that local school districts are limited in their individual reserves, how much mm-hmm. they can actually set aside. The governor's been a huge proponent of local control. Mm-hmm. So why are districts being limited as to how much a reserve they can carry forward?
Well, it goes back in certain ways to the rainy day fund issue. K through 14 education lost $9.4 billion in the recession. That's a hit that every school district felt. We now have a reserve within the rainy day fund that's going to insulate K through 14 education from those types of drops. And so the intent was to be able to have those reserves capped in years when we make a deposit into the rainy day fund or the year after that. So the design is we don't need as much of a reserve at the local level because we have a larger reserve statewide as part of the overall rainy day fund. A couple of notes on it. The deposits into the state's rainy day fund wouldn't be made until all of the cuts from the recession have been paid off. And secondly, it would only come into effect, the reserve limits would only go into effect the year following a deposit into that Proposition 98 reserve. So we don't think that there's going to be any short-term impact. But the design is we've got a new system in place, the rainy day fund's Proposition 98 reserve, that's going to provide a statewide insurance policy. That said, the governor is very much committed to local control. The budget that was adopted this year continues the implementation of the local control funding formula and adds nearly $5 billion to continue those dollars flowing and targeted towards students who are of low-income families, English learners, and foster youth.
Okay. Well, I want to thank H.D. Palmer from the State Department of Finance for joining us. Capital Weekly has said this about our next guest. We defy you to find another reporter, print or broadcast, who has had a greater impact within the California community about how state government is covered. We're fortunate and delighted to have John Myers, KQED's senior editor on politics and government, back at the Matter Report. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm not sure I agree with that, but we'll stick with it.
It's Thanks. In writing. It's got to be true.
Thanks for having me.
Well, great to have you. First of all, why don't you, for our viewers, why don't you summarize this year's budget? What are the key takeaways?
Well, I think the main narrative of this is the polite budget. This is probably the most polite budget season I think I can remember seeing.
I think the Sacramento Bee referred to it as joyfully normal.
Yeah. There was just something very quiet, and no one wanted to make a lot of waves, and there are political reasons for that we can talk about in a moment. But I think the key takeaways are that the budget uses the governor's more conservative revenue estimates and not those of the legislative analysts who had a more optimistic view of what revenues are going to look like. That, of course, colors everything, right? That colors how much we give schools. That colors how much we have left over for all the other programs. The governor gave some of what Democrats wanted on social services programs. They gave him a little bit of what he wanted on debt. Everybody kind of seemed to meet in the middle. And back to what I said a moment ago about the politics, I think the reason it was such a polite budget, it's an election year. Governor's up for re-election. He wants that narrative of, I have righted the ship of state. Mm-hmm. And legislators, Democrats, don't want to, you know, don't want to buck that trend.
It's interesting. We had the LAO Mac Taylor on earlier, and he said, I think he was reminding the governor that, you know, last year his forecast was correct.
Right, right.
So it's interesting. So it may be that we may have more money than we expect.
And I think the budget definitely has an eye to that. It has a number of these measures in them, trigger measures. Now, we've talked about those kind of things in the last few years, but they were like triggers of things that would be bad that would happen. Like, well, we would start cutting spending here if revenues went tanked. This budget, and I suspect that was part of the political negotiation here, which was like, okay, governor, we're going to use your numbers. If you're wrong and you're too conservative, we're going to trigger up some new spending. So higher ed would get some new spending. The payback of some long debts to local government would happen. So there are some things that will happen if those numbers are too conservative.
So I guess we'll see. Well, what about Governor Brown and addressing, you know, the wall of debt, this long-term liability issue? How successful was he?
Well, the wall of debt is mostly short-term versus long-term. I mean, it's some of these things, for example, the bonds that Arnold Schwarzenegger had voters pass in 2004, mm-hmm. fully retiring, those kind of things. The long-term debt issues, pensions, retiree health care, paying back general obligation bonds. I mean, there's no big change, I don't think, out of those. And I do think if the governor is fortunate to win that unprecedented fourth term, which I don't want to be a prognosticator, but he's looking pretty good, at least at this point, it'll be really interesting to see, does he attack some of those other long-term debt issues? He's wanted to wipe off that short-term debt in this first term. He's made a big pitch toward that, and I think this budget continues that.
And does he add maybe to long-term debt dealing with the water issue?
Well, that is one issue. I mean, one thing that is in this budget, you referenced long-term, and we talked about pensions, is some changes for the Teachers Pension Fund, CalSTRS. It does start to accelerate a fix for that, but it is not as fast as the governor even wanted. Democrats rolled that back slightly, I think supposedly to help school districts kind of get over this hump of having to put more in that system. But yeah, that could be one of them. We're talking about a potential school bond on the ballot. We've got a lot of things still to be determined.
You know, as part of the governor's rainy day fund proposal, he's saying that school districts have to limit their reserves. Mm-hmm. He's been a big proponent of local control. Why did that happen?
Yeah, it's an interesting, not quite consistent moment there, isn't it? The proposal to limit these reserves of school districts was late in the game, had not been identified in the budget process, was a bit of one of these late surprise moments. It was supported by a lot of the governor's political allies in education, actually most notably the California Teachers Association. The school districts don't like it. I think in the long run, it's something that's not going to come into play immediately, and it may not come into play for years. It's related to the rainy day fund, the overall statewide reserve fund. But it does beg the question of, don't local districts get to make their own decisions? Mm-hmm. And the governor, in his principle of subsidiarity that he talks about a lot, has a hard time, I would think, explaining that juxtaposition.
I always got to go look up that term whenever
I hear it. Yeah, smaller government is best.
That's
is what
right.
I think it means.
Yeah. Well, we only got about a minute left in the segment, but I want to ask you about these trailer bills. There are 19 trailer bills, and you've written about one, a multi-million dollar right. state solar tax that got into the budget. You said they talked about it for about 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Senate Republican leader Bob Huff criticized it, saying, you know, this is a backroom deal. Does the state budget process have a transparency problem?
It does still have a little bit of one, I think. Most of the trailer bills are implementing language for the budget. This one, which was this extension of this property tax break for solar installations, was not part of the budget, had no nexus to the budget year whatsoever, and yet was literally a three-minute discussion in budget conference committee and then quickly voted on in the night. Most budget watchers will tell you they think it is more transparent than it has been in the past. Bills are in print longer, people get to see them, but still, it is the most politically charged part of the year here at the Capitol, where everybody's in a hurry to get something done, and when you're in a hurry, you get interest group can get something in there.
Yeah, and this is a typical part of the budget process.
It is, and lawmakers want to get paid, I should point out, too.
Right.
That June 15th is big now because those paychecks
It's interesting. The budgets are now on time.
Amazingly.
Isn't that so? Yeah. Well, I want to thank John Myers from KQED for joining us, as well as Mac Taylor, the legislative analyst, and H.D. Palmer, the governor's spokesperson from the Department of Finance. Up next, what impact will the budget mean for the Valley?
We'll talk with Paul Hurley, the former editorial page editor of the Visalia Times-Delta, and California State University Fresno political science professor Jeff Cummins.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. So what does the state budget mean for the San Joaquin Valley? We've got two points of view on that question. Paul Hurley, the former editorial page editor of the Visalia Times-Delta. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you.
And Jeff Cummins, who's a professor of political science at California State University, Fresno. And he also was, he did work with the LAO's office, so he has more than an academic interest in the state budget. Welcome, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Okay, so let's start with you, Paul. How would you describe this year's budget negotiations?
What negotiations? There was very little talk about it. It was very friendly. I think he used the phrase joyfully normal. A budget season when there's no contention really isn't normal for California. It hasn't been for a number of years, but they did get a budget passed on time. There's very little dissension about it. Yes, Republicans complained about some of the late additions, but they really didn't raise a lot of opposition to much of the budget, which is basically crafted between the governor and the Democratic leadership.
So, Jeff, what are your thoughts? What's your overall summary? What are the takeaways of this year's budget? Budget. What does it mean for the Valley?
Well, I mean, I thought it went pretty smoothly as well. I think the one exception I would say is I was somewhat surprised that it went to the last day of the constitutional deadline to pass the budget, right up to June 15th. Of course, that's pushing the legislature's pay to the last second, because if they don't pass by that June 15th deadline, then they don't get paid.
Well, I guess so, you could say there's a cynical and a theoretical answer there. The cynical answer is they want to get paid to the last moment. The theoretical answer is everybody waits to the last minute in negotiations, right, because they want to get everything off the table they possibly can.
And I think there's a lot of last second things going on there, too, that they did want to wait till the absolute deadline, so there wouldn't be any going back.
But they did get it done, Jeff. So what are your general takeaways of the budget?
Well, I don't think there's a lot you can complain about in it. They did quite a few things. The first kind of surprising thing was how early they kind of put away the rainy day fund. They had negotiated that shortly after, I believe it was the May revise. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was a pretty masterful stroke by the governor to take that issue completely off the table. So it wasn't even part of the last second negotiations going on. And the governor got what he wanted up front, which is he wanted that rainy day fund, and he wanted to put some money away to pay down some of the state's debt obligations. So I thought overall the governor really got what he wanted. Ultimately, he gave in a little bit to the legislative leaders who wanted a few of their pet projects into the final budget plan, having to do with child care and a few other issues that we'll probably talk about. But I thought, you know, most of the major players came away with what they wanted.
Yeah, what do you think, Jeff, about the governor? He seems to want to run on a platform of fiscal prudence. You're seeing, you know, stuff in the newspaper about, you know, the water bond. He doesn't want to get behind a really big water bond because he is worried that it's going to somehow affect his narrative. How do you think it's going to play politically in November, his approach of fiscal prudence?
I think it should play very well and with good reason. I mean, if you think about what he came into at the beginning of his term, he came into a $27 billion deficit. And he has turned it around with the help of a resurging economy. But a lot of why the state is in a better financial position is some of the initiatives that he took on, mainly the fact that he was able to get Proposition 30 mm-hmm. passed, which was the sales and income tax increase. Without it, the state would still be mired in a deficit. But I think you have to give a lot of credit to him for really turning around the state's position and even starting to pay down the long-term obligations. They also started paying down made a big down payment on the CalSTRS, that's the Teachers Pension Fund, making a payment towards the unfunded liability there. So I think he's really got a lot of things to crow about in November.
Paul, how's this playing in Visalia? Does the governor view it as fiscally prudent?
To some extent, but Vice is pretty conservative. I think there's a lot of complaint about high-speed rail and that provision for setting aside a certain, what is it, $250 million a year for...
$250 million, that's correct.
For the high-speed rail. And I personally think that that's a good idea. You're using capital funds to pay for a capital project and setting it aside. It's long-term kind of prudent. But I think... the governor still looked at with some suspicion in the Central Valley, and I would agree his strategy for going to appearing fiscally prudent and very conservative is the right thing to go as he faces what is his last election. Once he gets this behind him, then he can start working on even more on his legacy things, as we know, as the solving California's water problem, the tunnels, water from north to south. And high
train.
Speed rail.
And that darn train.
let me
ask you this. You know, one of the things that the governor's been pushing in a lot of his initiatives is local control. But in this year's budget negotiations and with the rainy day fund, he did something a little interesting, and that is, I don't know how school districts would feel about this, but he basically told school districts there's a cap on how much of a reserve that they can maintain.
I'm glad you brought that up, Mark.
So, what are the implications for school districts?
Well, I have to talk to the superintendent of schools in Visalia, Craig Wheaton, just yesterday about this, and it's kind of baffling because here the governor's strategy to set aside the rainy day fund and reserves for the state, and he was very successful in doing that just very right. It was very clever of him to get that off the table right at the beginning of negotiations. But then the governor in the budget comes back and says school districts can only, there's a cap, there's only 6%. They're going to hold 6% of reserves in their budget. And the superintendent and Visalia say that just doesn't make sense. I mean, we want 10-15%
What's interesting is that he's pushing for a 10% reserve in the state rainy day fund.
And yeah, exactly. But so where is local control? In fact, there has been some more attention to local control. That's somewhat because of the Common Core provisions. But this particular provision of the education funding, I think, is sticking the wrong way with a lot of local superintendents.
Jeff, what do you think? Why was that done?
Well, my understanding of it was inserted in there by some union interests, and that they're trying to put more money in the school districts to get them to spend it rather than stock it away in a savings account in the hopes that the districts would be forced to spend more on teacher salaries. I mean, I think in theory, it's not a really bad idea, because what it's based on is that as part of the rainy day fund, there was a second rainy day fund set aside for education. And so the argument is if you're setting aside this money on a statewide basis to fill in the holes when a recession hits to help smooth out school districts' spending, that the districts don't need as much of a savings account at the district level.
Yeah, so the governor's basically saying it's redundant to have so much at the local level?
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. The main problem I would have with it is that it's just not real good fiscal policy. I mean, you encourage your government entity, state, local governments, whoever, to save for a rainy day, and you want them to have more discretion, and it hurts their ability to have that discretion when they're not able to fill in the holes in the way that they want when that next recession hits. And then on top of that, just with the rainy day fund in general, and then the specific one dealing with education, I don't think there's going to be that much money there when the state needs it. And so I really question how much it's going to smooth the spending levels when the next recession hits.
Yeah, the governor said we'll probably say, well, at least it's a start. Let me transition to some of the programs, Paul, that have been cut that benefit the poor. During the recession, a lot of these programs were cut, and now that the economy is improving and revenue to the state is improving, you're not seeing a lot of these cuts being restored. Are there any programs in particular that would have a big impact on the Valley if they were restored?
Anything in education, especially higher education, community colleges are going to do a little better, and school districts are getting somewhat an increase in their budget. If the state would go full bore and fund full-day kindergarten, for instance, they are making some provisions for preschool, which is good. The other thing, obviously, is health care and what basically aid for children would be the important things that really need to be those funding levels need to be restored to full capacity.
I want to get to high-speed rail, but before we get there, Jeff, I want to ask you a question about other spending programs and projects that impact the state. If you look at this, as you look at the state budget, do you see anything in there? Any projects that are going to have a specific impact on the valley?
Well, I think just the ones that have already been mentioned, the fact that we're switching to the local control funding formula that increases funding where you have a lot of English as a second language students and a lot of lower income students. I would say that really helps out the valley given our demographics. The other major one that's in there is the Medi-Cal expansion. Mm-hmm. Right, so it's part of the Affordable Care Act. Medicaid is going to be expanded up to those households making 138% of the federal poverty level.
And that's good for counties. And that's good for counties because it takes that cost off their bottom line.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it takes that cost off. The state is just also expanding Medi-Cal aside from that to those who previously were eligible that weren't taking advantage of Medi-Cal. So I would say those are two really, really major state federal programs that are going to help out the Valley residents.
Okay. Paul,
those would have been better if they'd also restored reimbursement to hospitals and health caregivers, though. I know the hospitals aren't happy about the fact that the things are not changing there.
The reimbursement rates are low, and so they're wondering if doctors are even going to sign up for these things.
Yeah.
Well, let's transition to high-speed rail, Paul. I know that's a big issue. It's all big issue throughout the Valley, but certainly in Visalia and Hanford and that area. The governor wants to spend, as you've mentioned, $250 million in cap-and-trade revenue on high-speed rail, but not just this year, but as a continuing appropriation going forward. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it works both ways. I think it helps the cap-and-trade program. It gives that money somewhere to go that's actually useful, and it also applies it toward a capital project so that it's not just frittered away and dispersed in odd ways. Now, that is, of course, if you presume that high-speed rail is a good thing for California, and obviously very few Californians agree with the governor on that, and certainly nobody in the opposing party, and also he's even got some opposition among Democrats. I happen to think that the high-speed rail project ought to go forward.
You know, but the cap-and-trade money was supposed to be to bring down our 2020 levels of pollution to 1990 levels, and the argument against using this money is that, hey, listen, high-speed rail isn't going to happen to 2026, so you're not going to hit that 2020 target. So Jeff, what do you think about using this money to fund this project?
Well, I think the intent makes sense. The big question is whether or not it complies with the law or not. And so that's a question that's probably going to be resolved in the courts. I think it's a project worthy of it. If you think about all of the reductions in carbon emissions that's going to occur from train travel versus air travel or highway travel, certainly it makes sense from that standpoint. And I think I happen to be a big supporter of the high-speed rail, and I think it could be a game changer for our Valley's economy. And I'm a little bit perplexed that many of our leaders are opposed to it, although I see why, and that some of their more vocal constituents are not behind it. But I really think that it could be a transformative project for the Valley, and I don't see any other project, whether it's a private project or a state federal project out there, that could make the difference that it could in strengthening the Valley's economy.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, what else are you going to spend it on?
Dams. Yeah. I think someone would say. But let's go, Jeff, to the issue of Kevin McCarthy. He's now the House Majority Leader. He's come out strongly against federal funding for high-speed rail. You know, that $250 million is nothing to sneeze at, but this is a $68 billion project. So are we ever going to see federal funding to help fill that gap?
I mean, given the current very vehement opposition to it, it's hard to see unless the House of Representatives switches to Democratic control. I would like to see, you know, not only McCarthy, but some of the other Republican leaders. I can see them being critical of it. They're worried about it going towards a project that's not going to be finished. But what I would like them to see is be critical of it, but in a way that we can eventually get the project done. You know, try and educate folks on how it's going to benefit the Valley, and try and push for the changes that will get it done in an efficient way.
You know, what's going to be interesting is when they do connect it to Bakersfield, and there's that link between Bakersfield and L.A. that needs to be filled. I wonder what political pressure is going to come to bear on Kevin McCarthy to make that final connection, to make it a workable system. But we'll talk about that later. Up next, the implications about the state's unfunded long-term liabilities and the willingness of the voters to approve more debt, like a water bond, this November. This is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. We're talking about the impact of the state budget on the Valley with Paul Hurley, the former editorial page editor of the Visalia Times Delta, and California State University Fresno political science professor Jeff Cummins. So, Paul, let's talk about the state's multi-billion-dollar unfunded liabilities. Governor Brown has repeatedly said he wants to address the state's long-term liabilities. Was he successful in this round of budget negotiations?
Simple answer is no. I didn't see much in the budget that addressed those, didn't add to them. And unless there are provisions for using some money from the Rainy Day Fund or other things, I didn't see much progress being made on that issue.
Are you going to give him a higher grade, Jeff?
Yeah, I would probably give them a higher grade. I mean, it really depends on which liabilities you're talking about. There's this wall of debt, which is the debt that the state accumulated over the last several years where they were borrowing from special funds and doing spending deferrals. So the rainy day fund they created, you know, makes some payments on that. And that wall of debt, at least according to their plan, will go away in, I think, 5 years or so, give or take. And then the big long-term liability that was gaining a lot of attention was the CalSTRS unfunded liability.
And the CalSTRS, for our listeners, is specifically the teacher's pension fund.
The teacher's pension fund, exactly. And so they ultimately required all of the contributors, the school districts, the teachers, and the state to make larger contributions, and those contributions will rise over the next 7 years. And so I haven't seen the estimates on how much it reduces the unfunded liability, but I think that's a pretty big step towards meeting that unfunded liability.
Yeah, I think that what they're looking at is a 30-year plan to retire that debt. But right now they're looking at a $74 billion $74 billion debt with CalSTRS. That's
going to be a fight. The other interests of that are going to dig their heels in,
right?
Especially the teachers' unions and the school districts.
Right. If any money goes to pensions, then less money to wages, and so that's going to be obviously a discussion. Let me transition to the new water bond that may or may not end up on the ballot in November. So the state, if you add up all the unfunded liabilities, has about $340 billion in unfunded liabilities. There's a huge chunk of that that has been addressed, but we're still talking about another $240 that still needs to be addressed. Do you think, Jeff, that's going to scare voters away from approving any kind of long-term debt like a new water bond?
I think it's certainly concerning for those who are aware of those long-term liabilities. I think perhaps by the governor legislative leaders taking a chunk out of the CalSTRS liability, that could reduce concerns, or at least that's how the governor and legislative leaders could pitch it come November. I think what tends to happen when you look at some of the research on how bonds have passed in the past, that there's this wealth effect. When voters feel wealthier, incomes are rising, the economy is growing, the state's funding situation is getting better, they're more likely to approve these types of things. You're probably, well, it really depends on how the final water bond ends up, what type of opposition there will be to it. If there's pretty significant opposition, then probably its chances of passing would be pretty low. If there's not, then I would say it's pretty good, because in the past, bonds have passed at a pretty high rate in the state's history. We're talking, you know, probably 60% and above in the past.
Agreed, and the timing couldn't be better than this year for that.
Yeah, with the drought. I do want to correct myself. I said that there were $100 billion that's been a long-term liability. It's actually $140 billion of the $340 billion has been addressed. So we're really looking at $200 billion in long-term liabilities. Paul, let me talk about this long-term liabilities and its implications for political races coming up in November. Mm-hmm. You know, Republicans, generally viewed as fiscal conservatives, is all this discussion of long-term debt and unfunded liability going to help Republican candidates? I'm specifically thinking of Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen running for state controller.
Swearingen's case is kind of unusual, because if she is elected as a Republican in a pretty much, democratically dominated administration, she's going to have to work with political opponents and people who really don't think the way she does. And so she might not be able to express as much fiscal conservatism as maybe some other lawmakers. But most of the people in the Valley, it's not going to hurt them to express really a hardline fiscal conservative approach.
But she actually might be successful, because she has worked across the aisle with the Obama administration, and that's unusual for Valley Republicans. So
she has, and she has in Fresno, too. I just don't think she's going to be able to be too strident as a Republican standard bearer.
Jeff, what do you think about, you know, when voters are looking across the state and they see all these Democratic candidates that are winning statewide office, do you think they're going to stop and say, you know what, we need a Republican in one of those statewide offices to kind of be a check on, as a watchdog on the majority party? And that might help someone like Ashley Swearingen.
A certain element of truth to that, in that you do get a segment of the electorate that thinks that way. We see this in some of the research that's been done on how we get divided government, where we get a one party in the executive branch and a different party in the legislative branch, that there's some balancing that goes on, that voters consciously choose different parties for different offices. I think the problem that Swearingen will run into in the controller's race is that it tends to be very partisan. Mm-hmm. It's not as much of a political race as, say, governor or maybe attorney general. There's not as much attention focused on it. And so it's going to be really hard to
well, it may be this year, because it might be the one race that's actually competitive.
Yeah, I think it will be competitive. I don't think there's a lot of awareness of what the state controller does. Mm-hmm. So part of it is going to be fighting or trying to educate voters on what that position actually does. That will in turn depend on how much campaign funds she gets. You know, does the Republican Party, other outside interests come in and support her and give her a lot of money to get her message out? So I still think it's going to be an uphill battle.
I think it's probably going to be waged mostly on the basis of personal and demographic appeal, however.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see, you know, how that plays out. But I want to ask you, Jeff, about, you know, the end of this budget process had, like a lot of budget processes have, these trailer bills. There were 19 trailer bills that came in at the last moment. Republicans have criticized the budget as, you know, the result of a backroom deal. Do you think the state budget process has a transparency problem?
I think it does, but I would say that it's mainly and probably obviously at these last stages. Because up until then, it's pretty public. The governor releases his budget. There's public hearings and all of that sort of thing. And it's just in these final stages. The big, now it's the big three. It used to be the big five, with the governor and the legislative leaders negotiating the final elements. And I'm not really sure if you can have a different way of resolving all of the final issues. I think the one solution that makes the most sense is to have some delay in the time that the trailer bills are printed and the vote that takes place on them. That's been pitched before. So, you know, allow time to have those reviewed and to be scrutinized. But outside of that, I don't see another way where you can negotiate those final parts of the budget.
Yeah, negotiation really can't take place in a matter of just a few hours. I mean, Mark should know this. But there are a couple of simple fixes, and California Forward did propose one a few years ago. Jeff, you alluded to it. Have a 72-hour sort of period between the time the bill is the trailer bill is posted and the time it's going to be voted on. So at least it gives lawmakers a chance to look at it and understand it.
Yeah, it's a kind of one of the problems with the trailer bills. They're saying there was one bill on solar energy that was sunsetting, and they said, you know, the whole point of a bill sunsetting is we're going to do an analysis to see if it's working. And they didn't even do the analysis. They just went ahead and approved it for another few years. So there's a concern there if that's a good idea, a good way to kind of go forward with public policy.
Obviously, that's not the way it's supposed to work.
I would definitely agree on that. It's definitely subject to manipulation. There's no doubt about that.
All right. Well, we're going to end on that note. I want to thank our guests, Paul Hurley, the former editorial page editor of the Visalia Times Delta, and California State University Fresno political science professor Jeff Cummins for joining us. Thanks a lot. If you want to keep up to date with state and local politics, you can sign up for our free e-newsletter, The Maddie Daily, by just logging on to our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Maddie Report Valley Views Edition is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio and the nonpartisan Maddie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on important public policy issues.
This is Mark Kepler for The Maddie Report Valley Views Edition. Thanks for joining us.